I mean, this is a smart thing to do, but it's also a little depressing.
I don't just guess what the future is. I say, what is the worst it could possibly be, and can we handle it?
Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 3rd of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Jamie Dimon coming up in just a little bit, 4 minutes from now, give or take. But we are going to begin today with a, well, one hesitates to use the word wonky, so one will hedge by saying slightly weedy economic fundamental. It comes to us via the New York Times expose on President Trump and his family finances. The Times reports the president took part in, quote, dubious tax schemes and another, quote, outright fraud that let his father transfer to the president at least $413 million, and that is in today's money, and in the process, minimize the tax burden. A lawyer for the president, we should say, denies any claims of tax fraud or tax evasion. And in a tweet this morning, the president said, quote, the failing New York Times did something I have never seen done before. They used the concept of time value of money in doing a very old, boring, and often told hit piece on me, end of quote. Setting aside for just a moment the old, boring, and often told bit, what exactly is the time value of money, and what does the president think it has to do with the Times piece on him and his taxes? Marketplace's Marielle Segarra gets us going.
The time value of money is, well, I'll let Jennifer Bird Pullen explain. She teaches tax law at the University of Kentucky.
The basic concept is that a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow.
Or a dollar next week.
You can do more with that dollar if you have it today than if you have to sit without it for a week.
You could invest it in the stock market, put it in a savings account and earn interest, use it to buy real estate. Tom Scriver teaches business at Cornell, and he says the time value of money is fundamental to business decision making. Let's say you own a manufacturing company. You're deciding whether to expand an existing factory or build a new one.
The new factory might take longer to come up and running, but then maybe it has higher returns in the future.
So you need to think about whether those higher returns will make up for the lag time when the factory is being built and your investment isn't making money. Jeffrey Fosselman at the wealth management firm Relative Value Partners says this concept matters to individuals, too. He says sometimes clients want to keep money in cash rather than risk losing it.
When you're talking about the merits of investing versus not investing, there's a cost associated with not investing, and that is due to the time value of money.
It's not clear what President Trump was referring to when he tweeted about the time value of money. He wasn't specific, and the Time story doesn't mention it. The writers did adjust all their numbers for inflation, expressing them in what's known as today's dollars, but that's a different concept. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Inflation, one hopes we've explained it to you guys, right? I mean, right? Anyway, self-driving cars are the future, as we know. The only question, really, is how much that future is going to be worth. And we got a hint of an answer today. Honda announced this morning it's going to invest $750 million in GM's autonomous car unit, with another $2 billion coming over the next 12 years. That is a whole lot of money going into products that, right now at least, are more fantasy than reality, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
The next generation of autonomous cars, not something you can churn out by your company's next board meeting. Michelle Krebs at AutoTrader says self-driving car projects need serious investment.
This is a really expensive venture. We don't know when they'll be ubiquitous and profitable.
Honda is investing in GM's self-driving car unit, which has been working on driverless taxi and delivery services. Krebs says the partnership is meant to look more Silicon Valley than Detroit. That brings in more funding. Auto analyst Marianne Keller says other car companies have been following suit.
It seems like you wake up in the morning and there's yet another announcement of a collaboration for something with someone.
Toyota is working with Uber on autonomous cars. Chrysler's partnered with Waymo. Keller says automakers need partners to both invest in the future and actually manufacture cars in the present.
They cannot forsake continuing investment in their current business model.
But Honda's partnership with GM could give both companies a competitive edge, says Stephanie Brindley with IHS Market in Detroit.
General Motors is one of the lead players in this space.
She says GM made a smart move by acquiring the driverless startup Cruise. Even before Honda's investment, GM attracted billions in venture capital. And Brindley says Honda brings expertise in engineering.
They have a terrific ability in terms of packaging and finding space inside of a vehicle.
The head of GM's self-driving car unit said its cars could have things like giant TVs and minibars. That would need a lot of space. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street this Wednesday. You know, sometimes I say forget stocks, watch the bond market. Well, today is one of those days. Yes, there were record highs in equities, stocks in other words, but debt was where the action was. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Park Avenue in Manhattan is about a six-minute walk from the Marketplace New York Bureau over on 3rd Avenue. It was drizzling last Friday when we headed over to the headquarters of J.P. Morgan Chase. Security guy met us, took us up to the 48th floor where we cooled our heels for a little bit, waiting for Jamie Dimon. That's on us. We were early. So we had a chance to poke around a little bit. Lots of sports memorabilia on the shelves. Business and management books, too, interestingly enough. Bank history stuff as well. Dimon showed up pretty much on time. We did the usual chit-chat as we got settled. Talked about how we got into banking. He's the son and grandson of stockbrokers, by the way. And then we got down to it.
Do you think people understand banks in this economy like you understood banks when you were a kid?
Sometimes people understand banks as a consumer. So, you know, if you've taken a mortgage, you have a checking account, if you have a business, you need a loan, if you're a large corporation, you have to sell equity or debt, that they understand. They don't necessarily understand the inner workings of a bank.
Does it matter?
Well, it does to me, but I don't think it should matter to the customer. No, what the customer wants is a good experience and, you know, a good credit card and a good, yeah.
Yeah, but does it matter whether American consumers understand the way the financial system works?
I think it matters that they understand how business in general works. So if you don't have a financial system, you don't have an economy. So the financial system is just part of this great economy. And America has the widest, deepest, most transparent financial market the world's ever seen. In total, I'm including private equity, venture capital, the formation of business, the transparency of our capital markets, and no other country in the world has it. It's not even close. It's kind of a part of the engine that makes us the most prosperous economy in the world.
You come to that, we come to that, not without some scars, right? And we'll get to the crisis a little bit later on. But what do you think the financial sector's role in this society is? What is the bank's responsibility in this society?
I think the most important thing is you help grow a prosperous economy that helps the most people. And it creates the wealth by which you can take care of your old, your sick, your poor. And so I think people should understand that you need a healthy banking system. And my daughter asked me in the financial crisis, you know, what's a financial crisis? I said, well, it's the kind of thing that happens every 7 to 10 years. I wasn't being facetious. I was looking at 1974, 1982, 1987, 1990. And one of the things that makes me cautious is knowing all that, I always, always, always wanted to run the bank that we can survive anything so that we're there in good times and bad times, and more importantly, in bad times for clients.
Lots in there. We're going to get to the crisis in a second, as I said. I want to talk, though, for a second about corporate social responsibility, which you and this bank are a believer in.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
I've never believed that the only thing is to maximize shareholder value. In fact, I don't know any CEOs who are that way. I think these companies...
How come everybody thinks, oh, companies just want to maximize shareholder value?
It just becomes a narrative that gets repeated over and over. Companies have to do a very good job over an extended period of time to get customers back. Companies that take care of customers succeed. If they rip off customers, they don't. To me, if you don't take care of your employees, you don't take care of your customers, you will not have financial success. Okay? And so they're all related. And taking care of your customers and clients... they want you to be a good community citizen.
You were in favor of the president's tax cuts and his deregulatory moves.
I was in favor of the president's business tax cuts. So separate business from
India. Okay.
Because it's very important. If America wants the best economy it could possibly have, it should have a competitive business tax rate. That is a sine qua non. The notion that you can have the best economy in the world with a super high tax rate compared to your competitors was driving capital and companies and brains overseas. That was a mistake. On the individual side, I didn't ask for personal tax cuts. I didn't need one. So that was not our driving thing. So the business community was like, we need a competitive tax system to be competitive. And then, you know, do we have to do on the other side to help pay for all this, all the things that we need to take care of America?
Help me understand how... regular people see that benefit, right? What's the benefit to society?
Well, there's several benefits, okay? But if you have a healthy economy, you'll have more jobs and more wages. And that's all directly related.
Yeah, how are we doing on wages so far? Come on.
Yeah, not so good. But part of the reason is because you have anemic growth. Yeah. And when the health bill, when the tax bill first went through, companies did raise wages. They did.
No, they gave bonuses, right? That's mostly
they did both. Some did bonuses, some did capital expenditures, some did wages. The real benefit is cumulative over time as capital is retained and reinvested in the United States. Capital drives productivity. Productivity drives growth. Productivity drives wages. It's a cumulative effect over time. The damage was cumulative in the past. You didn't see it all at once. It's just one of the reasons we were at 2% growth and not 3% growth. And so that we need to have a competitive tax system, have a competitive economy.
Do you think big companies in this economy get a bad rap?
Sometimes, but I'm not sure it's worse. I mean, if you look around society, everyone's getting a bad rap. Press gets a bad rap. Politicians get a bad rap. Lawyers get a bad rap. Doctors sometimes get a bad rap. We've become a bad rap country. I mean, I wish we were more positive than we used to be.
You know, it's funny. There's a picture in one of your sitting rooms out there of the bank at night lit up, looks really good. And then there's a plate underneath with a quote from J. Pierpont Morgan. It says, "The first thing is character before money and property and anything else."
Right.
Sounds like you don't think we're doing so well in that.
No. I actually think there's a lot of character in the United States of America. I think we're just tearing at each other for some reasons I don't fully understand. But I think most people have pretty good character. But the first thing is character. And when J. Pierpont Morgan said that, he was also referring to, it's not about the models of credit. And I always tell economists, you can have all the models you want, but character and culture isn't in a model. And we have to make those judgments too. Like, one of the most important things we do is who we do business with. If I have crummy clients, I'm going to have a crummy bank.
So that's part one. More of Jamie Dimon in the second half of the program. The financial crisis, of course. Also, where this economy stands today. Don't look now, but your local sports franchise is becoming a real estate company, too. Bloomberg reports today the Green Bay Packers are going to build more than 200 homes just a block from Lambeau Field. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more now on Sports Club as development company.
Green Bay Packers management thinks young people will scoop up that property next to Lambeau Field. But Patrick Risch, director of the sports business program at Washington University in St. Louis, says there's a problem. Most young Packers fans live and work in Milwaukee, a two-hour drive away.
Are millennials going to want to commute from Lambeau Field down to Milwaukee for work and then back home at night? I don't see that.
Connor Jansen does. He's a 21-year-old student at the University of Texas. He's a Houston Astros fan and says he'd love to walk out of his apartment and be right at the game when he has tickets.
But I would see more of a pull for people who want to work with like Airbnbs.
That is, buy a place near the stadium to rent out to others during games. For the franchises, developing real estate next to the stadium makes a lot of sense. The National Football League, like all the other major sports leagues, has a revenue sharing agreement for its teams that covers things like TV revenues and ticket sales, not real estate, says Washington University's Patrick Risch.
You're able to generate significant revenue from that you don't have to share with other teams in your sport, and that's huge.
But when a franchise builds a new stadium, it's often in areas that have affordable housing, or at least housing options below market rate, says Nola Aga, a sports economist at San Francisco University.
When those areas get gentrified, when they get rebuilt, you're now pushing out people who have to move and now find more expensive housing somewhere else.
And she says it's not clear that stadiums actually generate an economic gain for the communities and cities where they're built. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I'm going to be competing one day with the Chinese banks, folks. I don't say that lightly.
What the future holds for the biggest bank in this economy. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 54 today, 0.2%, 26,828. The NASDAQ up 25, 0.3%, 8,025. S&P 500 up 2 points. Call that basically flat percentage-wise, 29 and 25 there. As we talked about Honda and GM and that investment thing, Honda slowed down 4.25% today. GM sped up 0.2% on the news. Banks seeing green at the moment as interest rates rise. Bankers, of course, make money on what they can charge for loans. Since we are hearing from the CEO of a big bank today, let's start with Jamie Dimon's company. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 0.9% today. On those rates, by the way, as promised, economic optimism means less demand for safe government debt. Thus, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 3.17%. You're listening to Marketplace.
I'm Shepard from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I listen to Marketplace several times, actually every day, because it's got the economic news and developments that are important to me. I donate to Marketplace so that it can be available to everyone, and I hope you'll join me in this effort. Thanks.
To join Shepard as a Marketplace investor, donate online at marketplace.org.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We're going to pick up again with Jamie Dimon here, that interview we did last Friday in New York before, obviously, I got sick. And I'm going to preface this part by pointing out that Dimon is the last person standing. He's the last of the big bankers. He's the last of the government officials. He's the last of all the people who had key roles in the financial crisis who's still around. So that is where we're going to pick it up.
To the crisis now. Would J.P. Morgan be the bank it is today without us having had the crisis?
I think probably pretty much, yeah. I
don't think. No, come on, wait. You bought Bear, you bought WaMu.
No, I wouldn't, but I wouldn't buy Bear again, okay? We bought Bear because the United States government asked us to. It was a tremendous amount of risk for us. We paid almost nothing. Yep. I'm not arguing that, but it cost us $15 to $20 billion to unwind it. And we took the major risk, and we bought $300 billion of assets. You know, the Federal Reserve financed a very small part of it, not for us, for themselves, because it's just a bridge too far for us. And they took the high-grade mortgages. We took the low-grade mortgages. It just was a bridge too far. And yes, it helped the company. But
which is funny, because it was the first bridge.
I know.
I mean, Lehman came, and then WaMu came.
Yeah. We thought at that time, Hank Paulson, me, a bunch of other people, Ben Bernanke, et cetera, Tim Geithner, all thought that that could be a hole in the dike that we got to stop. We were wrong because, as it turned out, there was a succession of failures after that, and it didn't culminate in Lehman. Remember, the biggest financial failures of all time were Fannie and Freddie, which were government-designed vehicles. AIG,
which we're still dealing with, by the way, Fannie and Freddie.
Exactly. The AIG afterwards, hundreds of mortgage brokers went bankrupt. So, yeah, it was complex. I would have bought WaMu because even though we paid an extra price that we didn't think we should have paid, it put us into so many places. I forgot the number of how many branches we got. But in those days,
you got the one down the street from my house where I bank. I mean, you know.
Right. And so you're in California. Yeah. So we've gone from 700 branches to 1,000. I think it was a fabulous platform for J.P. Morgan to grow. So I still would have done that one.
Are you satisfied that we have the protections in place now to avoid something like that happening again?
Yeah. You should never be satisfied. And I want to explain that a little
point.
Bit. The regulators should, I would say, they really should be happy and take a victory lap. And I give you just do Lehman Redux. It wouldn't happen. They would have had not 20 billion of capital, but 50.
But because of the regulations
yes,
that have been put in place.
They would have had a lot more liquidity, a lot more transparency. If it did go bankrupt, at the moment of bankruptcy, it would have created another $100 billion of equity. It would have been the most overcapitalized firm in the world. The government can run it and do whatever they want with it. But think of it as an orderly unwind.
Yeah.
What happened with Lehman was a disorderly unwind where assets were thrown, people couldn't get their cash, markets were going to collapse because they had to sell assets. That was all fixed. So the capital, liquidity, the banking system is stronger. But with the way you should look at risk, I don't just guess what the future is. I say, what is the worst it could possibly be, and can we handle it? And to me, handling it means I can still serve my client. It does not mean I have to run in panic. But you should always be asking that question. Where's the next problem coming from? It will be different from the last problem. Cyber attacks on other institutions, clearinghouses. And I'm not worried about shadow banking, but there are always going to be issues with shadow banking. So if you're a regulator, you should be really cautious about what's happening away from banks.
Are you worried about, you know, given all that, cyber and all of that, are you worried about the Fed and its actions? And are you worried about politicians and them stepping up?
Again, I'm not worried about both, but we plan for both not being exactly the way we expect it. So I think the Fed is doing the right thing in raising rates. The economy is quite strong, and they're just, I think it was just normalizing it. But, you know, is it possible that down the road something happens, there's too much inflation, the Fed's going to move quicker? That's possible. So I'm not predicting it, but my company can easily handle it. But it is possible. Just like the tariffs can cause problems that you don't anticipate today. Just like cyber can cause problems. Just like Brexit can cause problems. I mean, you always got to be looking to figure out and make sure you can handle bad outcomes.
You keep jumping ahead of my list of questions because I want to get to tariffs in a second. Okay. But look, let me back you up for a minute on the healthy economy. And I'm not going to argue the headline facts, right? Yeah. Jobs, GDP, all of that good stuff. But as you sit here on the 40-whatever-it-is floor of this building, looking out literally at the American economy, there's income inequality, there's wage stagnation, which has just recently started to pick up. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some not small problems.
Yeah. So the American public should understand that this is the most prosperous economy the world's ever seen.
Yeah, but
I want to talk about the good and the bad. Okay. So the good is we have wonderful neighbors in Canada and Mexico. We've got all the food, water, and energy we need. We have what the founding fathers gave us, freedom of religion and freedom of speech and freedom of enterprise, the best universities, the widest, deepest capital markets. And yes, income inequality is a real issue, and we studied it, and there are fixes to it. The economy has been growing anemically, and it was driving low wage growth, less small business formation, and all these other things that we need to fix.
Okay, but look.
And there are fixes. The American public should know that everything we talk about, there are fixes for if we put our minds to it and kind of drop this Democratic-Republican view of it all.
I appreciate the positivity. Yeah. Truly, I do. But there's some reality here, right? We have serious problems with many other countries in this global economy. Mm-hmm. We are pulling back from the international arena. The president said at the UN across town a couple of days ago, it is America first, right? So how do you reconcile that with what you call for in your letter, which is intelligent, thoughtful, analytical, and comprehensive policy?
We're
slipping. Do we have that?
We're slipping a bit. So but let me go back. We have not had war with Canada and Mexico since 1848. And Mexico has actually done quite well, and we should treat them very respectfully. But you're absolutely correct. This trade issue, I'm going to call it a skirmish.
What
people are afraid about is that it will get worse into what we would call a trade war.
So what do you see that's going to make it not get worse from a skirmish? Because it sure doesn't look like anybody's backing down.
We have advised the president that while he's Yeah, we have. And I know lots of CEOs have done it. And most of us said that we understand the issue to China, and he's right. Tariff barriers.
Intellectual property, all that.
Intellectual property, state-owned enterprises, subsidies, et cetera. I'm hoping at the end of the day the president succeeds in what he wants to do. And I say, hey, you know, your method worked. I'm just worried that the method can cause more problems.
So put on your most objective Jamie Dimon self here for a second and answer this question. Is it possible that you have too much power in this economy? You?
I don't think so. I mean, there are
You're pulling a lot of levers.
There are 28 million companies in America. I mean, you know, we are one actor of many in this economy, and there are a lot of other big banks. I'm going to be competing one day with the Chinese banks, folks. And I don't say that lightly. They have a bigger home market. They make more money. We're worth more than their market value. Some of these Chinese banks make more money than we do. They have aspirations, and they should. They're going overseas, and they should. They're following their Chinese companies overseas, and they should. And they will be competing with us in a lot of things. We also probably have to compete one day with Alipay and WeChat and Tencent. And so I look at the world. I'm not saying, oh, well, this is great. I'm saying, no, we're going to have competitors. I want JPMorgan Chase to be the best bank in the world. And I want it to be an American bank. And I think it would be a mistake for America if the best banks in the world and the biggest banks in the world were Chinese banks.
Well, so here's actually a good follow-on question. Do we as an economy get the benefit of your size that makes it worth the risk of you being so big?
Yes, because remember, a scale economy, and it's true for banks, it's true for auto companies, it's true for a lot of industries. The beneficiary of scale of economics is the client. It's not the company, because capitalism forces the return to the company lower. And also our size and diversity, it's why we had no issues through the storm.
There was a whole lot more to that interview, of course. Jamie Dimon on the next crisis. For one thing, we've got the transcript online. It's on our Corner Office podcast as well. Also, at marketplace.org, whether a cyber attack could actually cause the next financial crisis.
This final note on the way out today, in which I rise on behalf of all New Yorkers, grew up there, by the way, to protest the abomination that Apple is calling a bagel in the new set of emojis that is coming out with the next iOS update. Whatever that Wonder Bread-looking, smooth-crusted, frozen food section, clearly never touched by human hands, too perfect round thing with a hole in it is not a bagel. No, sir. Also, and this just in from the Marketplace desk of shameless self-promotion, Molly Wood and I are doing a Reddit AMA tomorrow. She, the host of Marketplace Tech, me, the host here, us together on a podcast called Make Me Smart. Anyway, ask us anything, I guess we ought to say, tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific, on the IAMA subreddit. Ask me about that new bagel emoji, maybe. How about that? All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 54 points today. That's about 0.2%. NASDAQ up 25 points, 0.3%. S&P 500, 2 points to the good, basically flat a la percentage. I don't know where that came from. Sarah Bregaire, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.